You are listening to Viva and Barnes, Law for the People. I am Viva Fry, David Fryheit, a Montreal litigator turned YouTuber. Robert Barnes is a world-renowned American civil rights attorney. In each podcast, we are going to break down and explain things that are going on in the legal world around us in terms that can be understood by everyone. The audio is pulled directly from our weekly live streams on YouTube, where you can find us on my channel, Viva Fry. And although the audio is not perfect when it comes to knowledge, knowledge is more important than audio quality. Enjoy your podcast. Without further ado, let us bring in the man of the hour. For a second, you looked very angry, Robert. So how you doing?
Good, good.
Now, I was told by someone that you're coming from Alex's podcast or Band TV?
Both. The Band.video. He does a Sunday show from 4 to 6 Central Time, 5 to 7 Eastern. And I was on the second half of that show.
Now, what was the subject of the discussion for those who missed it?
What the president's real plan is by his course of action, what it's not. That it's not martial law as he dispatched with ease last night. It's not Insurrection Act. It's none of that nonsense. It's to have his constituency put as much public pressure on Congress to have a meaningful electoral contest on January 6th, in part facilitated by sending out letters, by putting pressure in every way you know how, but also by encouraging a mass attendance at a rally in D.C. on January 6th. And so the goal is to have as many people there as possible so that Congress recognizes that that Trump's voters want a meaningful. So far, they've been denied any meaningful forum for resolution of whether this was a constitutional election. And that's the way I'm going to start phrasing it, is was this a constitutional election, not whether fraud or this or that, because that sort of misplaces the standard. The standard is, was this a constitutionally conducted election? And there's a lot of evidence that it was not. And so far, no one has given a hearing on that question.
And that's actually something that maybe we'll start with that, because there's the question as to what the Supreme Court decided in the Texas suit denied on standing. The Pennsylvania suits were denied on standing. A number of the other ones might have been denied on other issues. We haven't gotten, by and large, to an evidentiary hearing on any of the big suits. That's not an oversimplification.
No, I mean, there's a few small suits that have had small evidentiary hearings. Some of the Powell's Kraken suits have. There's been some other ancillary suits, but not these key constitutional questions. There's been no evidentiary hearing on those cases. And the original action, of course, by definition, it could only be filed in the Supreme Court. So if they didn't take it, there's no place to file those. You know, the president has replicated some of those claims, but there's no place for Texas to sue. There's no place for any of those states who joined the suit to sue. The Supreme Court was it. It was the Supreme Court or nothing. And and as to standing, you know, my position is still the same. I do know that I guess uncivil law took some umbrage to my position on standing. And so to uncivil law's credit, he has joined a long list of esteemed company of people who have cursed me out at one time or another. So that includes federal judges, some state judges, prosecutors for sure, some law enforcement agents, federal agents, high ranking agents, some law professors even. So he has esteemed company for his cursing. And but I will probably have to meme it. It is such a perfectly raw, unadulterated rage and anger. F you, Barnes, that, well, I'm probably going to have to meme it.
I think he took down one of the videos and then he did another shorter version the next day.
One that I'm going to meme because some people saved it for me. So because it's like that rage at the inauguration where that woman is screaming when Trump gets inaugurated. It's uncivil was a perfectly distilled version of that. And for people who, if you want the different view, he represents what I would call, he and Nate, the more institutionalist perspective on standing. Now, you, Cyril Dershowitz's position last night, his position is pretty much the same as mine, that standing should have been found here. And it was irresponsible of the court not to address the matter merits. And he agreed with me. The reason they're not taking it isn't because of standing as a legal principle. It's because they don't want to get involved, and that they were sending a signal to every court in the country, don't get involved. And it's for political purposes, not principled purposes. But to the institutionalist, they believe in all the doctrines that come down, and standing is the, one of the main doctrines that come down from the institutions. And so I am a heretic and blasphemous when I say that that's not a principled institution. That's not a principled doctrine. That's a power, raw power grab that's disguised with the fig leaf of principle that isn't there. And I obviously agree with Rikita, who had a rant. There's some other people who had some rants about how standing is, was bogus as applied here. And again, in my view, standing is not a legitimate doctrine. And just to recap for folks, one, it's not in the text of the Constitution. Second, it's not found in anywhere of the original discussions in the Constitutional Convention, the ratification debates, or in the first 130 years of our Supreme Court's jurisprudence. And third, it's been applied consistently, discriminatorily, and disparately. If it's a principled doctrine, you shouldn't find it so easily manipulated year after year, decade after decade, by court after court, the way standing has been.
Well, so I'll agree with Nate in a sense, because I think you agree with Nate in the same sense that standing is a call it a core legal principle. The fact that it's not in the Constitution doesn't mean that standing as a legal concept doesn't exist. If you're not a party,
exists, but it's just like the way I put it. I was putting it somewhere the other day. They're like, why don't you address standing in a suit or when you're planning a suit? So it's very simple. I could always tell my client, hey, by the way, if the judge doesn't like this case or like you, they got 20 excuses to dump it or screw you. And sooner or later they will. You can't really plan for that. You can't like litigate around that effectively. The judge wants to screw you. The judge will screw you. It just may not, instead of standing, it may be mootness, or it may be latches, or it may be ripeness, or it may be one of other 20 little excuses they have in their toolbox to play Pontius Pilate. But you can't plan for that or prepare for that. That's the predisposition of the judge. What I refuse to do is to respect it as an honest principle. I know that's what kind of got Uncivil a little agitated, but that opinion I'm not changing. No, if somebody really believes in standing, I don't take them seriously because they're an institutionalist, which is fine for them. But I don't believe in these institutions' fig leaves and self-excuses for their bad conduct, and particularly a doctrine like this that's so perniciously applied in politically problematic ways to hurt the outsider and hurt the underdog, I have particular moral objection to.
So I'm going to bring this super chat up only to say that we're not going to respond to it because the new rules of YouTube preclude certain discussion. And what we are discussing now is the law and not hypothesizing on certain questions.
I can tell people what I predicted before the election. I thought it would be Biden would get between 74 and 76 and Trump would get around 74. Trump got exactly that. According to the count that's been reported, Biden got more. And the question is whether those votes were lawfully cast.
Constitutionally cast votes, which is one of the questions now. But the standing thing, I think to some extent we're all speaking the same language, but you're taking it to a different level of understanding, and not in the intellectual sense, but another meaning. Standing, we all agree, you're not a party to the contract. You cannot sue under the contract. If you do, the judge will say you have no standing. So it's a core legal concept in that you have to have a legal interest in the suit to file the suit.
I put it, it's one of the excuses they have in their toolbox to screw you.
Okay, but
it doesn't mean it's a legitimate one, but it's one you, but that's when I say it's like, because the real motivation isn't the doctrine, but is what the judge wants to, the outcome the judge wants. It's not something like I take that seriously. And from a principled perspective, I understand that that's one of the things they can use. I mean, it's what I said that they were going to dismiss a lot of the Kraken suits on. But as I also said, that's bogus. Yeah. But but it's a reality, yes. Reality is they say standing matters. It doesn't mean it's a legitimate, morally legitimate legal doctrine.
But you did mention something, and I noticed another lawyer also agreed with you that it became, the term was, I think, institutionalized in the 20s. So yeah. You have the idea of standing, which is it's a core legal concept. It's the base concept. If you have no standing, you can't sue. Sometimes the question is a little harder to decipher. For example, if you're not a party to the contract, you can't sue under it. If that contract was ceded to you, you know, maybe they'll deny standing for whatever the reason, but it's a more nuanced question of standing. Now, what I wanted to flesh out was the development of standing, what you refer to as the institutionalizing of the concept in the 1900s to 1920s, where it became used as a political tool and not a legal principle.
Right. I mean, what's now called standing is really an ancillary doctrine, because what it borrows from are old doctrines that, of course, you have to actually have suffered an injury. You have to be the one that was either party to the contract or the subject of the intended injury. unless, of course, you're suing Alex Jones, and then you don't have to suddenly have standing under any legal theory. But then, and you still are allowed to sue, you know. So that, again, that's where these doctrines are interesting in their application. But I think standing has been a made-up doctrine that borrowed from legitimate cores of areas of law. Like, you had to have a real injury, you had to have a causation, you had to be someone that was protected under that tort or contractual principle. Just like latches is. I mean, latches has a legitimate equitable history. It's just been misapplied in a way that has never been intended. Standing for me is just a made up doctrine that takes, that borrows from legitimate doctrines, throws it together in this Frankensteinian mix. Because here's the problem. If they were applying it honestly, here's what the Supreme Court would have had to say. The Supreme Court would have had to say there's neither a case nor a controversy between the states before us. Now, that would sound absurd and absolute fraud, but that's in fact legally what they said. That's what standing is. It's under the causes and controversies definition of the Constitution. But they know they can't say that with a straight face without people being like, what? So they used a nice little phrase that was invented about a century ago for them to get out of their problems. So I don't, I'll never take it seriously as a legal principle. I'll never take a lawyer who actually believes in it as a principle seriously. Of course, when people say, hey, by the way, a court can give you standing or deny you standing, absolutely. That's a recognized reality. That doesn't make it a moral principle worthy of merit.
Now, one of the other points that Nate is bringing up is that the Supreme Court does not have a say in interpreting state law. And so if there were a dispute on whether or not Pennsylvania's state law were unconstitutional, setting aside whether or not it impacts the Electors Clause in the Constitution, if there is any final say on whether or not a state law is unconstitutional, it's the Supreme Court of the state and not SCOTUS. Now, I don't know better. I just thought SCOTUS could nonetheless still adjudicate on state law. So am I wrong?
See Bush v. Gore. They had no problem getting involved in state law. But technically what they're doing under the Electors Clause, the state of Texas wasn't asking them to interpret state law solely for the purpose of state law. They're asking, was this passed by the state legislature or not? And did they deny equal protection or not? And did they deny due process? All of that is federal constitutional principles.
And this is where I mean, Nate and I debated on Friday. I doubt you watched it because it might have been
a long debate.
Sorry?
It was a long debate. I saw parts of it.
Because no, I'm just fundamentally saying this is not a state law question in the sense that it's speeding on highways. This is, even if it is at its core a state law issue, it is a state law issue that impacts the Electors Clause in the Constitution. And therefore, it's a different type of state law that the Supreme Court could rationalize getting involved in, much in the way, from what I understand, they did in Bush v. Gore. And if they're not going to get involved in it, at the very least, they have to explain how this is a purely state law with only state consequences and no national consequence the way Texas alleged, which they absolutely just did not do in their two-liner.
Correct. And because it impacts the presidency, they've often got into this issue. So Anderson case, I've litigated this a lot for independent candidate access to the ballot. And those are always filed as federal civil rights claims. And it's because if it involves the presidential election, they interpret and decide issues of state deadlines, issues of nominating petitions, circulating petitions. So it's not a question of purely state law, because it impacts a federal office, a constitutional office, and constitutional principles. So I understand where he's coming from, but it's not applicable here.
No, and I just say fundamentally, never trust a lawyer. No, fundamentally, it's a different type of state law, even if it is a state law. I'm trying to think of like environmental examples where state law of river pollution can impact the downriver state, and I could imagine SCOTUS getting involved.
Well, interstate commerce. I mean, almost all civil rights laws are regulating state laws. I mean, segregation was just a state law. And that's all that was. They just struck it down as unconstitutional because it violated equal protection rights. We have federal civil rights laws that don't allow a local employer to discriminate. I mean, so that the states' rights doctrines mostly ended with the Civil War, but they definitely ended with the civil rights movement. There's very little left of states' rights doctrines, whether you like that or don't like that. That's a reality. This court would have had no problem getting involved if it was a different president.
Well, they would have argued from that conclusion and given
Dershowitz made that argument last night. Dershowitz was like, look, if this was flipped, of course you recognize standing. So But that maybe that's a good bridge into Dershowitz. I mean, I thought a great interview, great broad interview. You hammered him a little bit, 60 Minute style, a little bit of Barbara Walters in there. You know, by being really nice, you could ask these aggressive questions. But he's unafraid. And he's I forgot how New York he is. He is so New York. Yeah, I mean, he's ready to brawl right away.
Two things. First of all, I love that you picked up on the fact that you don't have to be aggressive jackaninny to get to ask the really tough questions. And I listened to Dershowitz on, it was called Tough Talk. It's a British guy. He asked questions that were not at all as hard as my questions. He asked it with clear bias, clear antagonism. And, you know, Dershowitz answered properly, but, you know, Dershowitz and I get along. And I told him, I said, it will be disloyal to my audience not to ask the obvious questions. I can't avoid these subjects without totally discrediting myself. And I know that I asked harder questions than anyone's asked him before, or more direct questions, I should say.
Oh, and yes. No, I mean, they're right to the point. Well, it's the benefit of lawyering and depositions, because the kind of question you get right to the point in depositions. And I think the only questions that actually, well, one, people I will interpret, it's like watching Russians talk. People interpret them as arguing with each other. It's the nature of their language, actually. It threw me off the first time I saw it. I was like, holy cow, everybody's mad at each other here. And it's just the language. New Yorkers the same way. New Yorkers, direct, curt, straight to the point. I have many, many New York stories along those lines. But I forgot how much he's a New Yorker, because I've seen him in different contexts and settings over the years. I think it was some of the trolls and some of the commenters that actually got to him a little bit. He was ready to get on the streets. If he was a little younger, he was ready to go outside.
I don't think he was reading the chat, but he knows what goes on in the chat. He's on Twitter. He sees the responses. Some people are saying he was hard on your audience. I was like, well, first of all, the core audience doesn't take that personally. And the people that he was hard on, I suspect they were only there to dump on Dersh. And some people just don't like him, and that's their prerogative.
Well, he's a New Yorker. That's however you were like somehow people like the way some people respond to Trump. There's a certain New York style that's a New York style. It's brash, unafraid. I kind of like it as a style. I wouldn't necessarily want to live next to it every day. So I like the South, but I respect the style. I've long respected the style. The New Yorkers are worthy adversaries, intellectually, politically, legally. I've always found that to be the case. The best prosecutors I've ever gone against are from New York. Toughest people in the political arena from New York.
They're direct to the point, and they say things which other people might take as an insult, which I did. You know, when he said, when I said I couldn't do criminal law, I couldn't morally deal with it. And he says, yeah, well, you stick to YouTube. And everyone's like, oh, that was so harsh. I was like, no, I know that he meant that as a compliment.
Exactly. He's curtain to, they're just, no, he doesn't take the edge off. I've met much more brutal New Yorkers than Dershowitz. I remember being outside this high-end place outside Central Park. And this model walked by, I just watched her walk by, and the doorman behind me said, "Forget about it." I was like, "That's New York to the core." So they're straightforward, unafraid. But that, if you want truthful, honest, blunt discussion, always find a New Yorker. If you want someone to give you the unvarnished reality of the world, find somebody from Queens or Brooklyn, and you'll get it. I mean, that's why Giuliani has been effective in certain settings. He's very straightforward to the point. And so I thought Dershowitz did a good job fighting back and showed the worthiness of his advocacy. And when he launches on that righteous rant about criminal defense lawyers, about their role in the adversarial system, I mean, you can see he both believes in it and he gives it its most persuasive advocacy.
And this is the other thing. He's unapologetic about it. And this is what I ultimately, my takeaway is, it doesn't matter if you like it or not. He's right about it, period.
I've tried to explain. Actually, I used his Letters of a Young Lawyer, the book that he wrote when I was a kid lawyer, to guidepost me, because I have a different take of how I handle clients. But it's based on Dershowitz's book, which he said it's not. He's like, everything isn't for everybody. Not everyone's made out to be a criminal defense lawyer that believes in the adversarial process, that recognizes that if you really do believe in the adversarial process, and to explain to people in sort of a distilled version, the idea is this: who are we to judge someone? What if we say we will never take a guilty client or someone we don't like, then the net effect of that will be innocent people will likely be convicted and go to prison, and the adversarial system fails and the justice system fails. And so we aren't God. And so our ability to assess or ascertain truth or justice is not, we're not in a position to do that as well if we compared to if we have an adversarial process that is most likely to produce truth and justice than us playing God with any individual client. Now, I myself don't represent anyone I don't like or I think is guilty of a serious moral crime. There's some things I don't consider a crime that, as Martin Luther King said, it may say a crime on the books, that doesn't mean it's a crime. But that's only because, not because I disagree with Dershowitz about the role of a criminal defense lawyer, but because based on his own book, Letters to a Young Lawyer, I'm not good defending people I think are guilty or I don't like. It leaks out. And if I'm not authentic to the jury, I will hurt and impair the case or the client. And so I don't take the cases that I don't like. I don't take cases. There's a whole bunch of areas of law I won't defend. I would never defend Epstein. I would not defend someone accused of what Epstein is unless I believed without doubt they were innocent. But that isn't because I'm morally superior. That's because it will show up in my ability to do my job for that individual. I will not be an effective lawyer for someone I think is guilty or bad. That doesn't necessarily make me morally better. It just is reflective of who I am.
Well, and I go for a different reason. Let me just try to get, how do I get this chat off? I go for a different reason is I wouldn't defend the Epstein types specifically because I don't want the name to be in the same breath. I don't want that to be something, an image on my reputation. And admittedly, it's sort of cowardice. It's sort of protecting myself so that I don't experience the type of guilt by association that Dershowitz is now experiencing. And that's, you know, dogging the later, you know, the end years of his career. But
it hasn't been an issue for me because I've associated with anybody and everybody, including some very people that are hated, people that are loved, people that hate each other. So, you know, you name it. So that's never been motivating for me, but that's because I don't care about that. But but that's where I thought his advice was great. And I thought he would come back to it a little bit more, but just that his book, Letters to a Young Lawyer, said, look, do what you're good at. Don't do what you're not good at. Do what you love doing. Don't do what you don't love doing. And that he believes that he doesn't believe every lawyer should be a criminal defense lawyer. In fact, he believes just the opposite. He believes it should be reserved to people who are able and capable to be effective advocates because they believe in the adversarial process more than they believe in anything else. Associational values, personal sense of self, any of those things. And he's right about that. He's right that if we don't have those lawyers, innocent people go to prison.
100%. And if you don't have those lawyers, people withdraw from files because it's politically, there's political pressure. And then you have a system that is effectively run by the mob.
And governments get away with bad stuff. And sooner or later, that bad stuff will hurt you and yours.
And I just want to also clarify my aversion to the Epstein types or even certain types of clients. It's not a question of being unpopular. It's a question of just not wanting to associate with people that I don't want to associate with because there is something of an overlapping effect or a rubbing off.
And that's where now I don't think like here. And this is a good bridge into the whole Dershowitz Epstein allegations related to the all those suits between him and David Bowie's and one of the accusers and all the rest. And there's a couple of things with that. One is I don't think he still fully understands how much Epstein was running an entrapment operation. And I think a large parts of the audience still don't understand that. In other words, they think Epstein was just like he was a pimp that you showed up at his house and there are a bunch of 12-year-old girls hanging around. That isn't what Epstein was doing at all. Epstein was running a very sophisticated entrapment operation, infiltration operation. And for that, he tended to, if you read all the stories, he would create an image of himself and his setting that mirrored what the other person would like to think of themselves as. So it would change from play. Like if it was a math nerd, he created like math nerd discussion kind of little groups and dinners. If you were a media personality, you wanted to be important, he did a big high-end dinner at his New York Manhattan place. If you're Bill Clinton, you're invited to the island in Palm Beach and everywhere else. Depending on who you were, he mirrored who that was so that you didn't know what was coming. If you showed up at Epstein's place, you're often introduced to him as some as different things. So to some people, you were introduced to him as a financier, a Wall Street whiz. To other people, you were introduced to him as one of the biggest donors and contributors to universities and academia. Other people were introduced to him as a math whiz who was pursuing math and science creativity in the world. Other people were introduced to him as a high-end socialite that did wonderful high-end dinners. And if you wanted to be part of important New York society, you would want to be connected to him. And then some people were introduced to him as who he is, But often that side of him, you were not, he often would not reveal that to you directly ever at the beginning. And if anything, it would be to measure and tease out what he, where he could put you in a bad setting so that you could look bad. I didn't know Rothschild connection existed until Dershowitz mentioned it, which is one. In part, I ignore a lot of the conspiracy theories because some of the there's so many people that just hate Israel because it's Israel, and there's clearly anti-Semitic conspiracy theories out there, and they tar and feather legitimate concerns. I mean, the Rothschild actual banking family, Macron worked for the Rothschild Bank in France. I mean, there's an actual history there. They've gone politically underground, and it has nothing to do with Jewish ancestry or anything else. But that's politically tight. I mean, you're talking about high end aristocracy, and that shows you the sign, right? Dershowitz isn't introduced to him as, hey, there's this guy that hangs out with 12-year-olds. Would you like to come? No. Well, Dershowitz is introduced to him as a Rothschild person. This is a very important man. You should know this person.
And you know, a donor to Harvard, where he's a tenured professor, a big donor to Harvard. It's like it's one of those things where you have an obligation, an expectation to be courteous and you know, to woo them some more because they finance.
People forget, the Rothschild family was a key reason Israel ever got off the ground. So if you go all the way back. So and Dershowitz is a strong defender of Israel. So if you're Jewish, you're a strong defender of Israel, you're at Harvard, you want to respect academics. You know, they hit every single button with how they introduced him, with how Epstein got his introduction to him. I mean, that was well done. And that's why people don't understand that this was an entrapment operation that, I can't get into details without disclosing attorney-client information, but I saw a very similar Epstein-type operation up close and personal in LA. And this is how those operations work. And the people have no clue what they're getting into. Though you're right. I mean, people said, hey, Eric Weinstein knew what this guy was like. But that's because two things. Weinstein's at a different level. Second, he was introduced to Epstein as some sort of financial whiz, and Weinstein's a real financial whiz, so he knew a fake one when he saw it. So that was why it was never going to work with Eric Weinstein. But there were a lot of people that read him. But given how he explained how he was introduced, that made a lot more sense. I will say up front, I still don't believe the allegations against him. I don't. And here people are like, the one they don't understand, in my view, the whole background with Epstein. He had tons of people in and out of his social world that had no clue who he was because of how he was very sophisticated. I still believe he was part of an intel operation for somebody.
That answers one of the super chats I brought up. Corliss.
Yes, I've no doubt about that. I do think he was connected to Robert Maxwell. Robert Maxwell was doing intel operations for multiple governments. Really, five or six, frankly, until the intel ran out because he decided to take an involuntary swim one night off his boat. Now he had the nature of those guys is they're often connected to fraud scandals and other issues. That's why, you know, I have John le Carré's novels behind me in honor of his passing, but also because he was one of the great authors. But if you read, you know, Taylor of Panama, you can understand how these kind of things work. Russia House, how some of these things work. The nature of that world, the people who occupy that spy kind of world, inside and outside, are often morally dubious people who independently and separately get themselves into trouble or who have other bad habits or bad morals in other aspects of their life. But same with, of course, with the Elroy novels. So Epstein was very good at what he did, though. That's what I think people didn't fully get because they got the debauched version of Epstein. They didn't see the sophisticated version of Epstein that managed to go in and out of a lot of worlds without people knowing who and what he was. And so now we can't, or we're like, how in the world do you go to an island where Epstein is? But back then you're just being invited to a rich guy's island. It'd be like being invited to Branson's island.
No, you know,
it doesn't have the same resonance.
And one thing I didn't know, like I think a lot of people have formulated opinions on incorrect facts or not knowing. And I say facts as in positions. I always thought Dershowitz frequented the islands, and I thought he frequented the islands at the material time. I didn't know, if you believe what he says, and you know, innocent until proven guilty, that he had only gone once in the late 90s and was not involved in, you know, repeated back and forths during the relevant period. So knowing that, it'll frame the thing a little differently, and I think most people didn't really know that.
And that he had completely disassociated with him socially as soon as he found out what he was about. Unlike some other people, Clinton, unlike some other people.
And that's what, you know, in Dershowitz, for all of his good pleadings and his mind, you know, when he gives a few interviews where he says some sound bites that are not that I told him yesterday that will, you know, will come back to haunt you, given the nature of the internet where you pull one line from a 10-minute interview. And, you know, when he says, when he brings up the Clintons, it's not the best defense because there are different, you know, there are people who infrequented or went once, like Dershowitz, and there's other people who went multiple times during relevant periods of time when things might have been more known than less known.
Well, it's always been interesting to me. I mean, the backstory of the way I filter that. The other thing is the way he's been sort of all over the place and defending himself early on was a sign to me of innocence, not of guilt. Again, guilty people already have a map in their head. They already have a planned story in their head about how they're going to get out of a situation that's problematic. Where innocent people like Roy Moore are going to be all over the place. Because they're trying to remember. They're trying to, like, how could someone perceive this? I don't think that happened, but so on and so forth. So that to me was attested to his innocence, not his culpability. But the other component of that is the main accuser, again, the second aspect is they should have a pattern of this behavior and they should fit a certain profile in all of my working for victims. Because I saw it all the time. I've seen chats in our locals board and other places where people are saying it's either got to be you believe everything a victim says or you believe nothing a victim says. That makes no sense to me. And I was glad you brought that up with him. I get why he's hostile. He feels this person has deliberately lied about him to destroy his reputation and his legacy. I mean, I dealt with that and I defended Wesley Snipes when he was falsely accused of parenting someone out of wedlock. He had nothing to do with the case. And now Wes always handled it more cool because when he was fully vindicated, all he said was, well, as the good book says, thou shalt not speak false witness of thy brother. So he put it that way without being too harsh. My view is just is a lot of I dealt it's because I have an experience that Dershowitz has less of, I suspect, which I've represented a lot of victims. And I mean, hundreds. And I experienced in my professional career, without getting into detail, of course, that it was not uncommon for them to be absolutely accurate about their primary abuser and to have false accusations against other people and sincerely believe those false accusations about other people. So they have various forms of amnesia that they use to describe this. And what I said up front is I was like, if this accusation is untrue about Dershowitz, one way you could prove it is you'll find that the accuser had a long, the earlier the onset of the abuse, the longer the abuse took place and the more people that they were victimized by. In my experience, that was a flag that when they accuse someone marginal, that it's not that you have to really vet that investigation, vet that accusation. And of course, his accuser does fit that pattern. And there's reasons for that. Like the person who falsely accused Wes of being a parent, she also thought that she and Wes had 8 kids together. They'd been secretly married. They were Cuban cousins, that the government had kidnapped him and gone to Mexico to make the marriage secret, that Oprah had stolen her appearance, that Prince had stolen her lyrics. It was because she'd had a mental break from a long history of abuse for which Wes became a hero when she saw Blade. Now, there are other indicators, the factual story, kind of like the accusations against Roy Moore. I think that the woman who accused him initially has been a victim, but I don't know Moore was the victimizer. And I think I just saw it too often. And early on, I had a lot of social worker types telling me, always believe everything. That backfired. So I learned that you have to apply these methods to discern. And I would say all the red flags of a false accusation, many of them are present in the accusations against Dershowitz.
Oh, I the only thing I said, and I said it to Dershowitz, and I've said it to him, is I can understand that he's angry with her. But the public, you know, the public sentiment is not going to take kindly to someone being overtly aggressive to someone who, by all accounts, is an objective victim, albeit to other people. But that's, you know, anyways, but he's 82. He's a fully vaccinated adult and he knows what he's doing.
He's Robert, from Brooklyn. So, you know, he just knows somebody lied about him and he can't accept it. Yeah. And I still think that I think she believes her accusation, but I don't believe that the accusation is true. And I think both of those facts can be true because I witnessed them in my professional career.
Okay. Now people need the election law fixed. So let's move on from Dershowitz. And I think you're game for it. I think we can get Dershowitz on and we can have a discussion on certain issues and, you know, it may be a debate. Maybe just he'll be part of the discussion one night or many nights.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's a living legacy, a living a genius, a legal mind. I mean, the two people that are still alive today that I studied the most as lawyers to sort of use as people to model one's career after for me, was Jerry Spence and Alan Dershowitz. I mean, his skill goes far broad and wide, just genius in one case after another, after another, after another. One of the great, great legal minds of our time. And I think someone who has been wrongfully smeared through this process, and the smear has worked mostly. I mean, this is a guy who was almost universally respected until these accusations surfaced. And it's not a coincidence David Bowie's is involved. So the he's now suing David Bowie's. Yeah. I'll be happy to help him with that suit. I do that. I do that work for free. I got some grievances with Bowie's myself. Well, there's no reason why Bowie's is representing any victim of Epstein's, because Bowie's is longtime friends with the Clintons, longtime friends with the Gores, longtime friends with a whole group of them. And somehow there's a phenomenon called captured counsel, that if you want to make sure someone's accusations don't go certain places, you control their representation. Is it really a coincidence that this victim makes no allegations against Dershowitz until after Bowie's is representing her? I don't think so. So I have had personal professional dealings indirectly with Bowie showing up and corrupting cases repeatedly for 20 years. So I just have great doubts about David Bowie's involvement, what it all means, what it all reflects. And for folks out there, there are people associated with Bowie's world and some of the accusers who are trying to make false accusations against Trump because of this accuser against Dershowitz met Maxwell at Mar-a-Lago. So that's why everybody should be careful about just accepting any accusation. Just because someone's been a victim doesn't mean every accusation they make is true. And they can believe something. And that's why you're right. It's a better PR strategy for Dershowitz to focus on Bowie's than to focus on the accuser. That the accuser is clearly been a victim. And in fact, a victim even before she ever met Epstein. Epstein targeted people who had been previous victims, because that's particularly area where he would have success re-victimizing. And so and Epstein also, people think sometimes they get the pedophile and other terms confused. Epstein's thing wasn't kids. Epstein's thing was power. So it went from 12-year-olds to 35-year-olds. And the only other person I ever felt that I knew publicly that fit that profile, and in my legal practice, that was pretty rare. It was usually people abuse kids, just abuse kids, and people that teenagers and adults or rape and assault. They're all different patterns usually. They're not like, it's not like a movie where the guy's a cheater and a wife beater those combinations don't quite exist in a normal person that often. But with Epstein, that's why he's accused of everything from assault. And like Dershowitz has never even been accused of. The only accusation was that Epstein told this accuser when she was 19 to have a sexual relationship with Dershowitz. There's never been a pedophile accusation against him. And yet so this is where people have mixed and matched tons of different stories. And a lot of what they've come up with have not been accurate. I know there's some people that have reasons to believe her side of the story, and that's understandable. Hopefully a trial will vet that out. My view is I believe he's been falsely accused.
All right. And we got Cleopatra is in the house, and people were asking before. She says, "Hey, David. Hey, Robert. Glad, good to see you on a Sunday night. Sorry, I'm late as usual. Sunday has come out. Sunday has become out night out. Okay, our night out due to much less people going out on Sunday. So what did I miss? Well, we finished
up. Dershowitz is innocent. Dershowitz is smart. Dershowitz agrees with Barnes on standing and on civil law and Nader wrong. That's the summary.
Yeah. Actually, the standing issue, the Texas lawsuit, it'll bring us into the other stuff. Why can Texas not sue in the state court of Pennsylvania? And what are going to be the outcomes or what's the next step for those state lawsuits that are pending? So first question first. Now that the Supreme Court says you don't have standing before SCOTUS because this is a state court issue, can Texas not go sue in Pennsylvania?
Can't. Because under the Constitution, the U.S. Supreme Court is exclusive jurisdiction for a controversy between the states. So you can't sue anywhere else. That's what made their standing doctrine even particularly incorrect. Now, there's a rumor circulating that, you know, Roberts was screaming at people and they could hear it in chambers. That was completely not true. I'll help you out. They're not meeting in chambers. That was they're still operating from home. So that was a cue that story was not true. Now, would it be like Roberts to be a wuss? Sure. But the key thing here was they, I think what Dershowitz said is correct. They were sending a signal, hey, judicial system, don't touch this election.
So there was a super chat earlier. It said, what do you think of the rumors of Roberts? We all think they're rumors. We think they're unsubstantiated. We think they're implausible by and large because they're meeting via Zoom and not in person. Regardless, the bottom line is, I think pretty much everyone understands that if this is not the determinant factor, it's definitely an underlying consideration. And we talked about it going back way back when the media setting this up in a way that there would be no way for the courts to do anything without causing upheaval. I mean, we talked about that for weeks before. So it doesn't matter if it's true or not. We know that this is, if not the determinant underlying consideration, at the very least one of them. So it doesn't matter if the rumors are true. Now, the only question is, ultimately, how long can the Supreme Court punt or refuse to take the question? What's coming up the pike for the Supreme Court? And what is the next case they might be called upon to take?
If Dershowitz and I are correct, and I'll say that anytime Dershowitz and I agree, because I just love saying that. But if Dershowitz and I are correct, the Supreme Court will not take up any of the cases. And all the people that would said, oh, no, it was a standing on principle doctrine. Well, what will be their excuse when they turn down every other case? My view is I agree with them. It was a political signal that they were not going to take any case. But because what I said beforehand was if they're going to take any case, it will be that case. If they're not going to take that case, SCOTUS is dead as an option and Congress is all that's left. Now, the president will prove that point by taking cases up. So there's three Pennsylvania cases the president has brought up to the U.S. that's now on petition for cert.
And stop there, actually. Which three? Is it, because I'm getting lost in the lawsuits, is it the one where it was dismissed because there was no injury in fact for the Trump campaign?
All of them. So that one, the one that came up through the Third Circuit, is now pending on a petition for cert. And two other ones he had brought in Pennsylvania are now pending a petition for cert before the U.S. Supremes. As Mike Kelly's case is still pending. They didn't grant injunctive relief, but his petition for cert is also still pending. So there's four Pennsylvania election cases on petition for cert to the Supreme Court. There's a Wisconsin federal case and a Wisconsin state case from the Trump campaign. Pending. There's a Michigan case about to be pending. There's an Arizona case currently pending. There's going to be a Georgia case pending. And then all the Kraken cases, which I'm not optimistic about, but they too are all pending on petition for cert to the Supreme Court. So if the Supremes want to get involved, they have plenty of excuses.
Well, the only issue is going to be now. So they are petitioning for cert, asking for permission for the Supreme Court to hear the case where they were dismissed on lack of standing. No evidentiary hearing. This is one of the Pennsylvania cases. So the Supreme Court is now going to decide, after having decided that Texas doesn't have standing to sue Pennsylvania directly under the original jurisdiction clause, now they're going to be called upon to adjudicate on whether or not the Trump campaign has standing to sue statewide. And if they say no...
But they don't have to. They can just decline cert without explanation.
Oh, well, okay. If they do that, it at the very least would be a tacit affirmation of the underlying decision, which denied standing to the campaign in the state for lack of injury in fact, in conjunction with denying standing for Texas to sue the state in the Supreme Court original jurisdiction for lack of standing. Who has standing? I mean, who has standing?
Now, a Wisconsin federal court said that he had standing. The Wisconsin Supreme Court said he had standing, but that latches applied. The Arizona Supreme Court said they had standing, but that no relief was appropriate. The Nevada Supreme Court said he had standing, but no relief. So some of these cases did say standing existed, but they wouldn't give relief for other reasons, latches, mootness, ripeness, any of the other pretext and fig leaves. But my view is if the Supreme Court is unlikely to take up any of the cases, if I'm right about why they did what they did in the Texas case. But Trump wants to prove that to everybody. He wants to be able to come by January 6th and say, look, I went through the court process. The courts are closed. The courts won't give relief or remedy. The courts won't even hear the evidence. So now you, Congress, need to do so. And I think that's the president's objective. The president's objective is not militia law, martial law, insurrection act, any of this nonsense that's being suggested. The president himself shot that down last night publicly. But there's a lot of this. Maybe it'll be one of my last references. But the whole point of the QAnon nonsense is become more clear because I was wondering, why did all these people suddenly believe, who are, you know, self-described constitutional patriots, suddenly believe that the solution is, hey, let's bring in the military. In fact, let's declare martial law and have the military run our country for a period of time. And it's like, let's just disband and end the Constitution overnight. First of all, we've never had national martial law ever. The closest we got to it was the suspension of habeas corpus by President Lincoln, which the U.S. Supreme Court determined in 1866. That was unconstitutional in the way he handled it, because he said the court made clear. In fact, it's a case I'm going to be citing, Ex parte Milligan. I'm citing in my lockdown lawsuits because it has a lot of stuff in there about how even during war, we do not suspend our Constitution. So how the heck are we suspending it for a virus, which we'll get to a little bit later? Mm-hmm. So there is literally martial law means the military runs everything. In martial law, the president doesn't run anything. In martial law, the military runs it. Now you could say the president's the commander in chief, and so it's functioning in that manner. But the martial law is not constitutional. It's not unless the entire country has no functioning civil government organizations at all. In other words, the courts are closed, the legislatures are closed, the governorships are closed, the mayor's office is closed, local police is not functioning. In other words, it's like a literal battlefield or a post-apocalyptic movie. Outside of that setting, you cannot constitutionally declare martial law, period. There is no, and not only that, for elections in particular, you can't use the Insurrection Act because after 1876, part of the compromise for giving Rutherford Hayes his fraudulency, the presidency, was that he would not only remove the military from the South, but they passed two laws that make it a federal crime, a federal felony for any member of the Trump has no interest. Go ahead, sorry.
So, no, someone actually said that is the march in Washington a honey trap? I assume that also means not just
if people are pitching this nonsense about martial law and Insurrection Act, then it's a honey trap. If they go there discarding and disregarding all of that and say, no, we're here for Congress to hear our voice. We want the constitutional remedy enforced. The courts didn't give it to us. The legislatures didn't give it to us. Our executives and our state governments didn't give it to us. So now the Constitution calls for you, Congress, to act and at least give us a hearing, at least give 2 hours per state, per chamber to have a meaningful hearing about the evidence, allow some argument. Hey, if they could take 2 weeks for Ukrainian impeachment nonsense, for an unconstitutional impeachment, they can take a few days for whether or not this was a constitutional election.
And now I had a question. Oh, yes, we discussed it earlier, but people are asking again, and I don't know the answer. I know what the 2018 executive order said about, you know, no foreign interference. Why are people bringing it up now, and what do they think is the impact? First of all, what is that 2018 executive order about prohibiting foreign interference in the national elections, and why is that coming up to play now at this stage?
It's part of the sort of Q-sourced, Lynn Wood-sourced, Lynn Sanity that's been taking place. So the pitch is this. The whole sort of Q theory, and I was always wondering what it would culminate into, and now it's clear. Because one of the big problems, all these people calling for the military to suddenly rule the country, it was very obvious they didn't realize that, one, the military wouldn't answer Trump's call, period. That's never going to happen. Trump can call for it, and all will happen is he'll be thrown in the hooskow the next day, and everything connected to him discredited and destroyed. The military is never going to go along with that. To the degree the military would have any interest in it, it wouldn't be on Trump's behest and behalf. And I realize the reason why people think this is because the whole Q pitch for years now has been the military is secretly with Trump. The Justice Department is secretly with Trump. The CIA is secretly with Trump. The State Department is secretly with Trump. The Pentagon is secretly with Trump. No, they're not. And that's been part of the problem. That's why they could lie for 4 years about how many troops were stationed in Syria. So the idea that they're with them is always been a QAnon lie. And what they built this story, which was that 2018, Trump signs an executive order. All it says is 45 days after the election, they'll do a review to see whether there was any foreign interference. Then 45 days after that, the attorney general decides whether such interference happened illicitly. Then after that, the secretary of treasury can put sanctions on foreign organizations. That's it. It doesn't go beyond that. But in the Q world, it became part of the secret trap to get all the bad actors, because the white hats and the bad guys are fighting behind the scenes within the deep state, and that the white hats were going to take over and they were going to use martial law to do it and seize the machines, and Hillary's going to Gitmo and Obama's going to Gitmo, and it's all lining up. This has always been nonsense. And, you know, the fact that the first biggest prediction Q ever made was Hillary was supposed to be arrested 3 years ago. How's that working out for you? And so all of it was always false. And this was a misunderstanding. And so they did the executive order. The director of national intelligence last week was supposed to, because 45 days came and gone, still hasn't even issued the initial report. Instead, they're going to issue it like in a couple of weeks, because here's what's happening internally. Pompeo, it's not a coincidence. The report doesn't come out, which people believe the report, Jack Posobiec and others have reported. Posobiec has intelligence sources going back a ways. He used to be Pentagon guy. And it puts blame on China and says that China attempted to interfere. So that first that report gets quashed. And then in comes Pompeo to suddenly blame Russia. Which, by the way, almost anyone who follows this knows there's no way we know who hacked SolarWinds. Because the nature of a state agent hacking is you're not going to track and trace who that hacking is to. In fact, if anything, there's going to be false breadcrumbs led to the wrong people. And yet Pompeo is eager to run out and blame Russia, because that's his agenda. He doesn't want Assange pardoned. He doesn't want Snowden pardoned. He's part of the deep state, folks. He's not really on Trump's team. It's another bad appointment Trump made at McConnell's urging. So the Pompeo's been a liar for years. And he's lied about a wide range of subjects. So that should be a clue to people that's not working in the direction that they think it is. But that's part of the theory. All that does is it issues a report, and maybe someday down the road, the Treasury Secretary issues sanctions. But by the time we get there, the president will have already been chosen. This will be after January 20th.
Okay. So we've discussed this, and I sort of knew that that's where you were going to go. That's where you're going with this, because we've mentioned it before. I saw a tweet the other day, I think it was yesterday, to the effect that Sidney Powell was going to be named, counsel to the election?
Special counsel. So the Department of Justice was going to appoint her a special counsel.
I called that fake news. I said, this is going to be a story that's going to turn out to be totally fake. No one's going to issue a retraction, but it's going to have served for a good couple of days of making fun or delegitimizing a process. Am I wrong, or are there truths?
There's no chance. There's zero chance that happens. The story was that General Flynn and Sidney Powell and some other people were in the White House talking to Trump, and that they were pitching, hey, do martial law, use the Insurrection Act, seize the machines, rerun new elections. Now, I mean, they are publicly pitching that. Lynn Wood has been publicly talking about that insanity now. He needs one of those. I think I have a Christmas gift for Lynn. It's one of those jackets that your arms don't move in. That's the kind he needs. That's what's happening in that context. There's almost no chance of any truth to it substantively. Trump had no interest. Last night he put out a tweet, martial law, it's complete fake news. I have no interest in that. I knew that from talking to him before. So that was always never going to happen. And Sidney Powell is not going to be appointed special counsel. What Trump wants is he wants maximum leverage brought on Congress by public constitutional means, because it's a win-win. Either they decide that, you know what, these electors do have to be thrown out. These elections were not done constitutionally. We have to go to the 12th Amendment process where the House votes by state delegation, whereby the president wins. Or they deny him, or maybe Pelosi denies him. And then he has the mantra to run for 4 years of, we need major election reform. The system in the deep state screwed me. We need to build a real populist machine to take over all the infrastructure out there politically, media-wise, and otherwise that we can, and bring a real lasting change in 4 years. It's Trump's MO. It's my favorite quote from his book, Art of the Deal. It's what, when I talked to him, he was already planning ahead. Plan for the worst, hope for the best. And here he's got a plan that works for both.
Well, and people are not going to like your perspective, your prediction, your position, because they're going to say we're going to have a dirtier, a less constitutional 2024 than we had in 2020. They think it's a fait accompli that the system doesn't come back after this if this passes. So, I mean, I know people are going to...
not American history. American history is after stolen elections, you bounce back and you recover stronger because you use that fact to build a political narrative that's strong. The only thing that could destroy that is if, you know, somebody declared martial law or tried to do insurrection act or use the military. That would discredit Trump and discredit Trumpism and discredit populism and empower the corrupt actors to have more power. But other than that, it's going to go the other way. And people keep underestimating the power of the public opinion over time. Just because you can steal one thing doesn't mean you can steal everything forever. That's just not true.
Well, no, I think people are saying, well, this is a unique moment in history. Back in the example you're giving, they didn't have social media. They didn't have big tech. What I think, you know, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes, like Mark Twain said. So I'm sure that there's similarities, mutatis mutandis, that they didn't have big tech then, but they still had ways of controlling the dissemination of information.
Absolutely. And they had Andrew Jackson was waging war against the First National Bank before it got established. So, I mean, you couldn't get more concentrated power than that.
Now, Nico Cruz asked a question which is very similar to what Jay Mill asked, and I brought it up, but let's get to this one. Now, wouldn't the best argument for VP Pence on Jan 6 to be to act as if no valid electors were sent from the contested states, including the GOP ones, to send the vote directly to the House by state delegation and force SCOTUS to rule? And Jay Mill says, because he has the final say in accepting the electoral votes, assuming he's seen enough evidence to cause concern, does Pence himself have the ability, the right to request an audit of the six states?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we've been talking about, is that on paper, he has that constitutional authority. He appears to be the sole official how it reads is that he will open up and read who the electors are and count the electors. That's how it reads. But it's been interpreted that he has sole discretion over that. And so that the theory that some lawyers are propounding is that he could say no. And in fact, other liberal legal scholars have propounded that. On our locals board, I put up some of the articles that come from these guys, which they say that there is an argument that the vice president has non-reviewable authority to say the contested electors are not qualified electors and not read them out. Now, my personal view is Vice President Pence would never do that, because I think he's a weakling at heart and always has been. But yes, there is an argument that he has that constitutional authority.
All right. Do we move on to another subject? What's another subject that this segues into?
I think, let's see. There was something I was going to broach that naturally. Oh, I know. I mean, to a certain degree, this does broach into lockdown suits and vaccination dispute controversies. Oh, cool.
And that's another overlap with Dershowitz about the vaccines. Okay, so first of all, you know, Dershowitz had got into a lot of hot water for his position on vaccinations. He said, you know, his, I don't know if the word is bombastic, but it was a hyperbolic, the state can come in and jam a needle into your arm, et cetera, et cetera. He explained it yesterday, says, you know, when it comes to a vaccine that's for the individual's protection, no state, the state cannot force it. When it comes to a vaccine that is to prevent infection to others, he thinks it can be authorized, and he thinks it should be authorized. In the case where it's, you know, the three elements are proven: efficiency, safety, and there was a third one. So, I mean, what do you think of that, and how does that play given what's coming or what might be coming with the vaccine in the states?
Oh, that does remind me. The other topic we have is the Smartmatic Dominion defamation.
Oh, we're getting that I have on my list. That we'll get to. But
here's where Dershowitz is right. His perspective is the one most judges will have, and that's their instinctual response. Now, I think that even though that is the way the law currently is in the minds of most judges and legal scholars, it's not what the law should be. And the question is whether the Constitution compels their conclusion, and if it does, whether or not we need new legislation. So the question is staying. I'll give him credit. He is slightly backed off his aggressive posture since he debated Bobby Kennedy Jr. And I'm going to be working with Bobby Kennedy Jr. on these kind of cases across the country, wherever and whenever we can. And he's an exceptionally articulate critic of, and these are drugs, and people call them vaccines. All a vaccine is a drug. It's just a nice label for a drug that sounds safer, but that's all it should just remember that, because if I say the word drug, you don't instinctively say, oh, that's got to be the safest thing ever. Instead, you're like, there's been problems with those. There's been side effects. Some don't really work. Whereas if I say vaccine, you think, oh, kids no longer have polio, no more smallpox. This is the greatest thing ever. So it's genius labeling and marketing, frankly. This is just a drug, just a concoction. And there are several, and the argument is from the Jacobson line of decisions, and it's why I hate the Jacobson line of decisions. So where I would challenge Dershowitz is, okay, I agree that if the draft is constitutional and Jacobson is correct, and all of their line of cases are correct, then you can do forced vaccines. But that also means you can do forced vaccinations, like the Buck, forced sterilizations, like the Buck case said. That also means you could just start detaining people anywhere in the country. After all, if you can force them to fight and die in a draft, then surely you can just go in anyone's house at any moment and grab them for any reason you see fit and send them wherever you want, because that's what they said in Korematsu. And in both cases, they relied on Jacobson. So you'll notice he didn't mention either one of those. He said briefly, hey, Jacobson has a long line of cases. That's true, but they're not the cases you want to be associated with, not in the court of public opinion, nor did the judges want to be associated with them. So that's why we have to expose that there have to be limits on Jacobson, or we get Buck, or we get Korematsu. And nobody wants that, even in the courts. And so the question then is, what are the limits? And in my view, here's the problem with it. He admits you can't get a forced vaccination for your own benefit, that it can only be a public good. And the short answer has always been, hey, look, if allowing someone to walk around spreading diseases is something that a state can't deal with, then the net effect is the state can't even protect its citizenry from a disease. What good is it? But the flip side is this: a vaccination is supposed to be able to prevent that. So if a vaccination doesn't, in other words, I am not at risk from you not getting vaccinated if I'm vaccinated, if the vaccination actually works. It's only if the vaccination doesn't work that then I can demand that you get it. But then how does that make sense? If the vaccination doesn't work, how can I compel it on anyone else? Well, because isn't the whole premise that it works?
He said one thing where he said, you know, like John Stuart Mill, your freedom ends at the tip of my nose, and applying it mutatis mutandis, your freedom ends at my lungs. And the idea that if you breathe something out that I breathe in, then I have the right to impose something on your body. The flip side being, if, you know, if that's where it is and you're afraid of what you're taking in, you know, who takes the precautions? And who makes that sacrifice of their freedom and their body? Is it the person who's breathing out, or is it the person who's breathing in? And if you're that scared, you know, maybe you breathe in somewhere else and not force the guy who's breathing out to have something done to his person that he doesn't want. And I'm not an anti-vaccine person. There's no but. This is just a question as to whether or not you go from being anti-vaccine, to being the state can force people to inject things into their body. And you'll have people say, well, there's already certain laws regarding certain vaccines for children. And in these circumstances, we're talking about things where you have the history of safety, not a warp speed vaccine, which is a miracle in and of itself, but not necessarily the type of example you want to have as the first forced vaccine from the state. So, I mean,
I can force something into someone's body for a remote. The other thing he sort of diminished was the quality of the risk. So smallpox was extraordinarily lethal and could be and it had a high risk of transmission. Here we have something that does not have a high risk of lethality. So if I can force people to take a drug, a forcible drug, inject their body, change their body chemistry against their will in the name of a virus that has a 0.001% risk for the bulk of the population, then I guess I could do that for anything. I mean, and where does it end? Where are the limits? Well, why can't I just control? Why can't I start doing AI in people's brains because it will reduce the probability of them committing crimes down the road? Well, I mean, there has to be limits, and his standards don't have enough limits on them.
Well, this is the issue: is his standards have limits that seem to be very broad. Now, the issue is, let's say it's 99%, a 1% fatality. Where is the threshold? With smallpox, it was 20%,
30%.
30% with these other, and which is, and even then, I mean, you can understand it, but then the question is, okay, is the flu shot going to become legally required?
Plus, we also know from Jacobson, they don't take the evidentiary predicate seriously, because they said everybody knows that this smallpox vaccine is in 1900 that they were discussing was safe and effective. What the litigant was trying to show, what Jacobson was trying to show, was he had evidence that it wasn't, and they wouldn't let him present that evidence. So we know that when the courts tell us what medicine says, we get decisions like Buck, we get decisions and what safety means, we get decisions like Korematsu, and we get decisions like Roe v. Wade, where they decide, I'm going to pretend to play doctor, take my black robe off and put my white robe on and tell you that I know what medicine is and when life begins. You know, I mean, making decisions that are philosophical and religious in nature. So priest, doctor, and judge all in one. When has this worked out as a good way for the courts to get involved in?
And incidentally, just to bring up Lucas Kaiser, one of Dershowitz's exceptions was religious exceptions, health exceptions. But, you know, it's
they're trying to get rid of. They're trying to get rid of those in New York for kids, for schools. And there's more studies out, by the way, that are showing that these are just not, that they do not have the benefits that are predicted. Even the ones for kids, many of the ones for kids don't have the same benefits. It should be an issue that should be up to individual conscience and individual choice. And here's my alternative view. If the courts are really not are going to allow forced vaccinations as a condition of employment, I think that potentially violates HIPAA laws. How can they require you to disclose your private medical information as a condition of employment? Some of these are, I think, violate discrimination against disability laws, because if you can have a psychological response, as many people do, to something being forced inside their body, and aren't you discriminating them against them because of perceived medical or mental condition at that point? And then I think we can, and there's some other claims that can be made too, but maybe what we need to do is codify, because this is what Robert Kennedy is really right. We agreed after Nuremberg never to allow this to happen. We agreed that Buck and all of those horrific decisions here that were then applied in Germany with the Nuremberg Convention said no more. That it said informed consent will now be the universal requirement as a matter of human rights before any medical treatment takes place against any individual and before any invasive medical treatment takes place at any time. And if we're not going to recognize and respect that in our American courts because of a virus that's less lethal than the flu to large populations, then what we need to, for young people, for example, then what we need to do is we need to do referendums, initiatives, legislation, constitutional amendments, whatever is necessary to include informed consent as a condition of it. And here's the other thing. I don't know how you'd claim that a state cannot ban abortion, but it can force a vaccination.
Well, but
those two don't make sense to me at all.
Dershowitz's argument is going to be one affects only the person. And I know people are going to say that's not true with abortion. It affects another being, but that's going to be the argument. It affects only one entity as opposed to the spreadable entity, which can affect, everybody.
He presumes the question of whether or not the fetus is a human person within the meaning of the Constitution. But the other thing there is that keeps going. Like when you're to the point where you're saying this, you doing something might impact somebody somewhere else, someplace else at some other time. I don't see how. I mean, you there's a whole bunch of things you could say that about medically. So to the point where you can just control a person's body and brain. I mean, there's no obvious limit to what he's laying out. I mean, he establishes at least a limit that it has to be good for other people. Can't just be good for you. I was glad to see he was clear about that limit. And I was glad for him to say that if you have allergies or a health response or other things, so
well, that kind of goes without saying. You can go into anaphylactic shock from any, you find out you're allergic to something the first time it happens.
I mean, yes. Folks, we tried this. We've only rushed a vaccine once before in response to a flu virus, and we've never had a successful vaccine for coronavirus. We have rarely had a successful vaccine that's consistent as to the flu. The reason is, of course, it mutates, and we're already hearing stories of COVID mutating, which means the vaccine would be useless against the mutated version potentially. But the last time we did this was 1976, and go back and watch the CBS 60 Minutes special on that. So, it was a disaster, total disaster.
And you know what? This is a good segue. I'm going to get this super chat. It'll give us a segue into Cleopatra's super chat, which deals with Assange and Snowden, which I think are going to be very interesting. So Mark Hargis, three questions for Barnes. Favorite cigar, favorite drink, likelihood of Trump running again if Biden does take office next month.
The best cigar I've ever smoked is a 1962 pre-embargo Cuban cigar, which you can still get occasionally. You can get some of them from from a little store up in San Francisco where he's got at the Fairmont on Knob Hill. It's about $250 per cigar, but yeah, that's one of those you smoke all the way down to the tiny little nub. I mean, just outlandishly good. What was the second question? Favorite drink?
Favorite drink.
You know, it depends, but Lafite Rothschild, the wine. Lafite is my favorite wine from particular years, late 1960s. Very good. Probably the best one I've ever had was 1896. It was just nice.
All right. And the third question we've asked is what are the chances of Trump running again if Biden takes office?
Very high. Very, very high. I mean, here's the other thing. When all these people get pessimistic and down and like it's over, it's fatal, it's futile, there's no chance. Trump doesn't handle it that way at all. Trump doesn't see it that way at all. So you're disagreeing with Trump when you think that, because Trump's purely optimistic. And, you know, so he sees it as he does not see obstacles. He sees opportunities.
Okay. Now, actually, there was one other question, which was a legit question on point. And
that's a good point by AM, by the way. Anything can be deemed to have a negative externality effect. And that's my problem with using that as the standard to invade people's body with experimental drugs.
All right. And this is on point. Can private companies enforce a mandatory vaccination? This is the discussion that we've been having. And it's going to be the reality is it's probably not going to come from government in the same way censorship is not coming from government now. So the question is not whether or not government is violating First Amendments. It's coming from big tech who are not answerable to the voters.
They're going to have to carve out exceptions for HIPAA and exceptions for ADA. Now, I bet the regulatory agencies are going to try to do that. And that's why I say that my first attack is going to be legally. And Robert Kennedy does great work on this. His whole team does great work on this. I was talking to them last week. They know all the ins and outs, all the loopholes, all the exceptions, all the variations, all the ways it's supposed to work, all the ways to attack it. So we're going to find every conceivable way to attack it. But what may be necessary is a universal recognition of changes in law or state constitutions or federal constitutions, local initiatives, local referendums that make it clear you have a right both against employers and corporations and anyone else that no invasive medical treatment can ever occur without your informed consent. That's the Nuremberg Convention. How in the world are we walking away from the Nuremberg Convention? Yet we are right now.
And I'm going to read this one out loud because I don't know if this person is an MD, but they say they are, and I'm not denying it. It's just the internet is what it is. MD on the front lines, mutation unlikely to affect 2 approved vaccines. Please, let's get this right. Lives are at stake.
I know that's what some people are saying, but then why exactly are they saying even after the vaccines, they're going to have to do lockdowns and masks? Why is that? I mean, either the vaccines work or they don't work. So I get people are claiming, don't worry, the vaccine's going to work for everything, so still get it. But the same people are on TV saying you're still going to need to wear your mask after you get your vaccine. These are contradictory statements.
Okay, now, Cleopatra's question. Cleopatra, thank you very much for being patient, and thank you very much for the continued support. I took a picture of it. It had to do with Assange. And the question is, what the status is now here? So once again, my question is, are we out of options? Is this the end? If so, then Trump has to dump all evidence and free Julian Assange. I don't think Mike Pence has the guts to object, and neither do any of our congressmen and or senators. So here's a couple of questions. Thank you, Cleopatra. Sorry for the delay. In Sullivan's 43-page diatribe, I didn't get into it so much in the video because I thought it would be a bit of an unnecessary detour. He did say pardons are not, you know, the Supreme Court has interpreted pardons as being broad and limitless, but they're not really like that. And there are some potential restrictions. So first things first, is there any way, legitimate way, plausible way for anyone to oppose a political pardon under the current state of the law?
No. And all this nonsense that you could reverse a pardon and all that crap, that's all garbage. Okay. So the pardon power is absolute. It's plenary. Once it's done, it's done. There's no reversing it. There's no changing it. There's no limiting it. Nobody can complain about it. I mean, not legally. There's no remedy. So it's final. And for people who say it can't be prospective, well, just go back and look at the Nixon pardon. It was extremely broad, and no one contested or challenged its application. So he can definitely do so as to both Snowden and Assange. I think he will look to do so Christmas Eve or Christmas Day. If you don't see it done then you are likely going to see it on January 19th if he's come to a certain conclusion, or after January 6th if he's come to a certain conclusion about him staying as president. So I think that's the time. I believe one of the two will definitely be pardoned. I'm hopeful it's both.
Now, and if there is a pardon, the first thing is with respect to Assange, he's still in, where is he now? He's in Britain.
He's still in prison, in a very bad, nasty prison in London.
In London. So, but the question is this: how does the president? What good is the pardon of Assange if he's in a foreign country in a foreign prison?
He's only being held for extradition purposes. He's already served his sentence under the British UK law. So as soon as he's pardoned, he's released. They have no basis to hold him in the UK anymore.
Okay, that's very interesting.
And the Swedish, they dismissed all those charges.
Yeah, but
there's no he's facing no other criminal prosecution. He's already served his punishment for bail jumping.
Okay, so I guess the optimist says they wouldn't find another reason to prosecute him, even if he gets a pardon in the U.S., say Sweden.
I mean, the U.K. could come up with something, but highly unlikely.
Okay, so they pardon him. He gets released because the only reason he's being held in jail is for extradition to the U.S. to stand trial for his indictment, which we covered. The question was just about to be, if they pardon him, that's going to be for all past wrongs, past alleged crimes. It'll be broad and cover everything. Does that mean that if Julian Assange has more information, he'll be authorized to dump it with impunity?
Sure, sure. I mean, no question. Now, I don't think he has personal access to that information at this juncture, but I think he'll be back in business within a year or two. He's not the kind of guy to go gently into the good night. I mean, I think he'll continue to do what he believes is important, and he would be an important asset for populist reformism, challengers, for outsiders, for people who oppose deep state policies and priorities. I mean, that's the reason why they went after him. They went after him for make him example out of him, but because he'd already proven that even when he was holed up in an overgrown closet in an Ecuadorian embassy, he could still change the world. And so that's why they had to shut him up and stick him in a tiny little cell. And you can see that there wasn't a big network outside of him because there's people who support him, but WikiLeaks has released nothing of significance since his imprisonment. So so he is WikiLeaks as a film kind of. There's one of the films on Snowden that really documented this. I think it's the one that Brent Cumberbatch, what's that guy? The guy that plays Sherlock Holmes, Brendan. I'm getting the first name wrong. Cumberbatch.
Cumberpatch is the guy, but yeah.
Yeah, brilliant, by the way. Great, there's a Snowden film. You can look it up with him in it. Fantastic, top notch. Citizen 4, also good, by Oliver Stone, about Snowden. But the good one on Assange is the one about with Cumberbatch. So so I think that was our first cinematic reference. Aside from The Russia House, Taylor in Panama, both good films, which maybe is a good bridge into, if you want to understand what a disinformation campaign looks like and why it looks like and how you can get yourself sued into oblivion, have your reputation completely crushed and bankrupted, you can watch the movies and read those books to understand how that works.
Okay, not yet, because we're good on time, but not yet. Two other questions. The pardon. So you don't think there's any information that either Assange or Snowden, even less so, have that they've been waiting to release so as not to risk further prosecution. So it's not like a pardon is going to trigger a release of anything. It's just going to be an act of grace on these two individuals.
Yes. But okay. It does give them the power to do things in the future. I mean, Snowden's not really in a position quite to do so in the future, but Assange has proven he could be and would be.
You think his mental faculties are still, I'm not saying this to demean it.
Yeah. I mean, he's been beat out. There's a lot of people who wonder whether he'll just retire on some island and stay away from it all. But having studied Assange for a long time and known people that are close to him, he has a pretty indefatigable will. And you give him the opportunity, I think you'll hear him. You'll hear his voice again.
All right. And now, can Trump pardon himself, his family, et cetera? Should he? I think I know the answer, but I mean,
Trump's not going to pardon himself. But yes, legally he can. There's no limitations on the pardon power, other than you cannot pardon yourself from the power of impeachment of Congress while you're still in office. That's the only thing you can't pardon yourself from, but everything else you can. And put it this way, they wouldn't have needed in the Constitution to have a whole provision that says the pardon power doesn't apply to impeachment if they thought the pardon power never applied to the person who was issuing the pardon in the first place.
Okay. And then we got, let's get a couple more here. What would be the impact of Trump declassifying everything as many anti-establishments are begging for?
I'd like to see some of those JFK files they've been hiding. They've been promising those for a while.
We all have priorities. I want to see UFO stuff.
The UFO stuff would be good too. All the Atlanta stuff. There's more Atlanta stuff that's fascinating. I mean, you saw like a little mini Stonehenge under the ice.
If I had known that those were methane bubbles at the time, I would have been blowing up the lake. Apparently, it is methane bubbles, which makes total sense because I saw them bubbling off the bottom, decomposing material. And if you poke through them, methane comes out. You light it on fire, and it's like a blowtorch. So we're going back. I'm gonna get it. Hands. Question. Cleopatra says some neighbors in Palm Beach who say Trump cannot live at Mar-a-Lago due to some old clause he signed with the city. He can just build another separate property on the 20 acres of Mar-a-Lago. Should that happen? Ridiculous. Yay to the pardon of Assange. Hey, we'll see what happens. I think
Laura Trump is going to be running for the Senate in North Carolina. I think Don Jr. is looking at where he might run. He might look at Montana. And I think the president will be back in Florida. He has some PAC coffers, some political action committee and other coffers of 100 million plus probably. And he'll start using his fundraising for his and his select causes. And whatever senator decides not to, or House member decides not to join in contesting electors, can look forward to being primaried in 2022 or thereafter. Trump is not going away anywhere. Any hope that he, and the thought that, could New York try to go after him? Yes. Biden's people have already made clear they don't want to get into the middle of that. So there won't be any federal prosecution of him. I suspect the state of New York and city of New York will also walk away. They don't have a history of taking on the Trumps of the world. That they doing it for politically important purposes while he's president, one thing. When he's not engaging into a massive war that could expose how corrupt their entire justice process is, that's a different animal. I think you'll see the city and the state of New York back down as well.
Good question here, actually. Peppermint, do pardons have to be made public?
In order to be effective, yes. I mean, because if you have a secret, pardon, what good is it? You know what I mean? I mean, the point of the pardon is to let the criminal justice process know they can't prosecute someone for a particular crime.
But it couldn't be done quietly and have a certificate so that if and when.
You wouldn't necessarily want it to be, because then what happens if someone destroys it or something else? It's risky. I mean, could he already sign pardon documents that he hasn't published to the world? Yes. You would want to make sure that information got public sooner rather than later.
Okay, now is the good time to segue into Dominion and Smartmatic have gone on the aggressive and started issuing demands for retractions and corrections. Now, first things first, a while back, this is where you're going to have to see people who were intellectually focused on an objective and, you know, thought they knew the answer. Everyone was saying, If what they're saying is wrong, Dominion should be suing. And if what they're saying is wrong, Smartmatic should be suing. And the fact that they're not suing is evidence that the accusations are legit. Now, I said at the time, I think that's superficial reasoning because it is not the case that there's a reverse inference by virtue of not suing. I still think you're innocent to proven guilty. And it's not because someone hasn't sued you for defamation that what you said is somehow true. That's backwards logic. And by the way, if you want to see the risks of what happens, just if you want to sue for defamation because you disagree, look at Johnny Depp. Now Smartmatic is going on the offensive. They're sending letters of demands out, demands for retractions to Fox. If Fox News didn't get one, they did their own fact check retraction of their own volition, potentially to avoid it. But they're going after people now and going after them aggressively. You'll get into it a little more, but my personal prediction is, retraction or no retraction, I don't think Dominion would ever sue because I think it would expose them to depositions, which I think they don't want. And so if I get a letter, there's some people are going to say if Sidney Powell gets a letter demanding a retraction, she's going to willfully not comply, hope that they sue so that she can then depose. So legitimacy of the claim, legitimacy of the demands, the strategy, and what do you think is going to be any outcome?
I think they now have to sue. I also think they've been waiting in wait to sue. So I think they wanted as many false accusations to be made because that would substantiate and expand and deepen their lawsuit capabilities. I mean, the problem here was this was not some small, little company that was never going to have the legal resources to wage legal war. Dominion is owned, and people get confused. Dominion does not own Smartmatic. Smartmatic does not own Dominion. They have no corporate overlapping ties of any kind at all. People are getting basic stuff confused. Like it's basically saying, well, you know, way back Smartmatic bought this company Sequoia, and then years later Dominion bought the same company. That doesn't make them related. That doesn't make them overlap, and that doesn't mean their software is interactive. They have both completely denied it. There's no evidence of it. They have been competing with each other for the better part of a decade. They've sued each other for the one time they worked together in the Philippines. So there's just no evidence of these claims. The no election stuff goes off to some foreign server. That never happened. There was no raid of any place in Germany. There are no servers related to the election in Germany. That was all false. Some of these ex-generals that they're listening to are nut jobs. I mean, one of them, the whole hammer and scorecard nonsense that people connected to the national security world, but that are very independent Trumpists, they've discredited that for years. They've been pointing out this was all nonsense gibberish made up by some grifters and fraudsters. And these one of the extra generals that everybody loves, that Sidney Powell loves, that Steve Bannon has put on too many times, though he's facing enough trouble, I suppose, so he doesn't got to worry about a libel suit to tag onto it. But is a guy who was a big Iraq War WMD hoaxer. So, and that's who these people, that's who people are citing, and they don't even realize it. The military intel people that Sidney Powell claims she had, one of them turned out to be an ex-mechanic. Wasn't a military intel guy. The Kraken unit wasn't a Kraken unit. It was an assignment unit. It had nothing to do with a high-end intelligence unit. So they made a bunch of, and we had been talking about this, and I've been pointing out many of these statements were provably false. They were not, I thought it was just smart. It was dumb as an evidentiary strategy, but you know, what better way to do a disinformation campaign that number one, distracts from the real issues that Trump has that are credible and viable. Two, that tars and feathers everyone associated with questioning the election because with these nutty theories and ideas. And third, you get to take out a bunch of your adversaries. I mean, Sidney Powell's going to be discrediting herself. She's going to face a bankrupting lawsuit. And it wouldn't be a surprise if she ends up suspended or disbarred. Lynn Wood is on the same path. Lynn Wood is already looking at getting kicked out of a case where he's representing Carter Page because of what they allege are false accusations made in a bunch of his different affidavits. And it didn't help, and in affidavit cases he was supporting, it didn't help that he submitted an affidavit that rather than saying under penalty of perjury, actually say, I hereby say this under plenty of perjury.
Hold on. It was a tweet that was going around. I did not retweet it because I was not able to verify if it's true. Because
It is. I confirmed it. It's on the docket itself.
Then I need that document because I said that's too perfect. That would be someone like, you know, changing it. Cause it would make no sense to have that as a typo. It said under plenty of perjury.
I hereby say these things, I verify these things are true. I mean, it's one of the worst faux pas ever. I understand typos can happen in the rest, but they've been doing this in all these cases. I mean, how do you keep making mistakes in case after case after case of just basic words, basic plaintiffs, basic names?
Not just that. I made the joke. It's like the only way that typo happens is if someone's dictating the affidavit. Like it's the only way that typo happens. But okay, no. So
that's what happens. You know, Woods, all of his ex-partners have left and they're suing him for being a crazy fraud. So he doesn't have the same kind of people around him that he used to. People tell me, oh, he's won all these great cases. To my knowledge, I don't know of a single jury trial he's ever won in the defamation context, ever.
But he
had an appellate one. I don't know of a single win. And he's going to defend Sidney Powell. If you look at those letters, those are unusual defamation level letters. They go through 25 pages in some cases of saying, you said this factually statement. Here it's provably false. All they ask, by the way, is retraction. At a minimum, I would respond. I would respond with what evidence I had. Say, here's what evidence I have. Tell me why it's wrong. Because then I'm establishing a record that I'm being fair and trying to do the facts. Instead, Lynn Wood wants to be sarcastic. He says, I read it. It don't mean nothing. Sue me. Sue her. Go ahead.
But what do you
they have to sue now? Because they're both going to, these are massive companies with deep pockets, but what state is going to give them a contract unless they sue and prove in court at this point?
Well, so I'm pull this up so that nobody ever accuses me of being pro-Trump. I'm being accused of being anti-Trump. So that's what I get it from both sides, albeit much less from one side than the other. What are you going to say to people? Because I can see it being a legit strategy. Sue me. I'll depose you.
I had a client that was doing that for years. He was waging war on Little Debbie because he connected the company that got him fired from a job as a whistleblower to the fact that they could be implicated by it. So he created like Little Debbie, and he took Little Debbie and he made her grow into like red and skeleton and all the rest. And his whole goal was he was to get them to sue him. The difference was, one, not many people were paying attention to his accusations. He was a very nice guy, by the way. But they were ignoring him. The second was he didn't have any money. So with So with there's, I mean, apparently the MyPillow guy has been giving hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to Wood and Powell, and that's just what's publicly known. Who knows how much other money they've been raising, because they've both been raising money off this. And so the so it could be millions and millions of dollars. That's part one. Part two is they're in a position where they have to do so in order to keep any business, because the Republicans are why Dominion exists. Democrats generally didn't like them. So what states are going to give any contracts to Dominion or Smartmatic while these allegations are out there? When the allegations were low key, no big deal. They're too big now. They have to get all of the media people to retract. Now, Fox was rushed to basically hit retraction, which was a sign, by the way, that Fox had no confidence in these allegations anymore. But the second aspect is that they're going to have to go through it. And when I was reading the suits, and based on investigation I've done, they're open and shut suits. So they can depose everybody they want, but they're not going to prove the allegations that they have. They're not, in fact, will be disproven. And then what will happen is the judgments used against them, they'll have to bankrupt their way out of problems, will be used to suspend and disbar them, just as it's already a threat of we're kicking them out of. Once you're kicked out of one court, you can get kicked out of every court. That's the way that game works. And you have to report it back to the state bar. And again, it's happening not because of political, well, there may be political bias involved, but it's because they got caught making statements that people could prove is false. For example, you reviewed that Michigan expert, and just all you had to do was look at his affidavit and tell people what your conclusion would be as a lawyer.
Well, so I mean, I didn't get into the details of the expert report itself, but yeah, it was drafted to be a partisan exhibit in a lawsuit. It employed subjective terminology, making accusations of intent as opposed to factual statements about coding. Now, admittedly, in the report, it talked about coding. I got a ton of emails and DMs from coders saying, you can derive or decipher or divine intent from coding because nothing happens by accident in coding. And I said, that's still, you would just say that this is the way it was coded without saying intentionally, purposefully, with, you know, by design to do this all on purpose. But
this is the guy that's already been caught lying in affidavits. He claimed that there was a bunch of over voting in Michigan, and it's because he confused precincts in Minnesota with Michigan. I mean, just basic mistakes that a conservative, by the way, outed a power line, which a pro Trumpist found this and were like, oh my goodness. The same guy has been going around for a while telling people that the deep state was started when George Soros, the Muslim Brotherhood, and some others got together in Nazi Germany in 1930s. Okay, that's not what happened. So the guy's into conspiracy kooky stuff. He's a partisan hack. He's someone who will be laughed out of court as a quote unquote expert. You know, if you wanted to do an honest review, get somebody that's an independent tech guy. There's plenty of Democrats that don't like these machines for that matter, but try to find someone that's an independent tech guy that doesn't look so bad that you can just look at his affidavit and say, oh, this will not come across as credible to a judge or a jury. He's drawing conclusions he can't draw. And if he's that partisan and that overt, then he's no longer credible as an expert.
But it's not even that. Like, there was something I didn't say in the video, which I probably could have. It said V2 on the report, which means that there was a V1, which means that it got reviewed and changes were made. And those changes are going to be discoverable as well. But I blame the expert less than I blame the attorney, because if I'm the if I'm the attorney, I say, tone it down. Just stipulate facts. We don't need this to look like it's, you know, a defense note written by your mother.
I mean, this has all been the signs of a disinformation campaign. They've had people, it's out of QAnon world where you pretend someone's a special intel expert and it turns out he's a former mechanic living in his mama's basement. You know, we're outed within weeks. And this is who most of Powell and Wood's experts are. They're crocs, they're jokes, they're crackpots, they're conspiracy theorists, they're tin cap nut jobs. So they're embarrassments. There's a reason why the president wanted nothing to do with them affirmatively involved in his lawsuits once he saw what they're up to. So that's why I'm saying in a court, when the real facts are tried, they're going to lose bad. I got everybody was all excited. This will prove it. Maybe they think that. That's not how this game is likely to end.
Well, and that's what I, you know, people think. Well, there's two things, actually. People think when you sue and you get to discovery, it's like a treasure trove. Depending on the nature of the lawsuit, the discovery has to relate to the lawsuit itself. So
You don't get to look at every single thing. It's got to be pertinent. And the problem is what they'll be looking for doesn't exist. And well, some of the other stuff like code and whatnot, they'll be subject to protective orders. So that will never get out outside of experts. They'll have to hire real experts, not their fake ones that are going to be embarrassed in court. They got set up in such an easy way that now they're in serious risk and they're still in denial that they're in serious risk.
Well, and let me just highlight this so that people can fully appreciate this. Let's say Dominion sues. It'll give, and let's just say it goes to discovery. The Powell side, the defense side, comes in and says, well, now we want to open your books. That's not exactly how it would go, because the issue is going to be, what information did you make your allegations on? Not now give us access to your books so we can prove the allegations we've already made publicly, which are the object of the defamation. So that's putting the carriage in front of the horse. So it's not as though strategically it's the, right, you know, it's the beneficial thing to do, because you don't go looking for the supporting evidence after you've been sued in defense discovery.
Right. So and judges are going to be very hostile to both Wood and Powell. So and they may just sue Powell. They may end up adding Wood to the equation. But I mean, it's clear they've thought it through. They're very well connected firms that are bringing these cases, well versed in defamation law. Powell's response of an over the top, come sue me. I get it. Maybe they really believe it. They're going to get destroyed in court. I mean, they just made ridiculous claims that just were never true. I mean, the Smartmatic was not created by Hugo Chavez. Smartmatic has no tie to Dominion. Dominion had never had a tie to any of those countries. Dominion's no longer even a foreign corporation. Dominion is and it was only a Canadian company then. It didn't receive a bunch of money from China. They confused which UBS bank was involved in a loan transaction. It's a very much deep state, Washington, Wall Street, Carlyle Group, Cerebras-based groups of people. Yeah. But they got a lot of money, and they'll have no problems litigating it aggressively. And I have no confidence in Powell and Wood's ability to effectively defend themselves. And I think they're at real risk of just getting wiped out.
And people are going to be angry with you, and they're going to be angry with you because they're not going to like what you're saying, or they're not going to like how you're saying it. The reality is, and they're going to say, Powell's going to lose with all of these, you know, these election claims that they might get sued for. They can't win on the standing issues. So what are they to do? And we know you've said it, you know, we've talked about it. One thing I want to say right now, 11,262 people watching. Everyone, don't forget, if you thumbs up now, I get to see that number go up in real time, and it's very satisfying. It's that little blue, it should be blue if you've hit it already, but give it a thumbs up or give it a thumbs down if you don't like what's going on here. But let's just see. I should remind you.
If you want to guarantee that I'll read your trolling comment, if you're a Lynn Sanity fan, if you're part of the Q cult, if you think I'm wrong, or you just want to troll me just for fun, you got to go to vivabarneslaw.locals.com, subscribe, and then I'll actually read. I read every subscriber's post. I read. Doesn't matter who it is or what they say. And there's people with a range of opinions there. It's been fascinating to watch. It's a great little community of like-minded people, but often with different opinions, questioning, curating information, bringing up questions, bringing up comments. It's been great to participate in, but it's the only place I'll be guaranteed to read your trolls, the other stuff. I get people bombard me with DMs on Twitter, and I quit reading most of those, frankly. So,
and it's like, Robert, some people are going to accuse you and I of grifting. There's a difference between grift and hustle, and Robert is very active on the locals. It's value added to anybody who's there.
My goal is to create a community, grifting. If I was grifting, I would be Lynn Wood. If I was grifting, I would be Sidney Powell. I'd be out there telling you all that Q stuff is going to happen, that all the bad people are going to be locked up in Gitmo. And all you got to do, Mike Lindell or Mr. Pillow Guy or anyone else, is just send me another $100,000 and it'll all be good. $5 a month isn't the money-making strategy for me. I lose money the amount of time I spend on locals.
And so, you're very active there. I'm less active on locals, but I'm on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, responding to comments here. Okay, the question I wanted to get into, I did a vlog on it this week. Tabarouette. I can't remember the it was, oh, well, let's talk about the McCloskeys now. Mm. What was the most recent development?
The judge disqualification.
Yeah. So anybody who doesn't know what's happening in McCloskeys, this is going to be the next Flynn saga, and it's mind-blowing. Everybody knows what happened to the McCloskeys. They're the couple who brandished firearms on their mansion property after protesters entered the private street. They were indicted on felony charges of brandishing firearms, which have to be readily capable of lethal use. apparently the pistol was not. The investigators disassembled the pistol, reassembled it in order to charge Patricia McCloskey. Well, okay, so I mean, if that's not mind-blowing enough, Mark McCloskey had made a motion to disqualify. It sounds like Kim Gardner and counsel are not doing the best of job in the file. They behaved in a way that the judge didn't really like by filing a response to the plaintiff's motion or the defendant's motion, but filing a response 20 days after the debate had occurred and it was under deliberation. So, you know, it's kind of a no-no to, after having argued and 20 days later without asking for permission, just to send a response to the judge. The judge disqualifies, it is Kim Gardner, I'm not making the mistake on the names here, Gardner from the prosecution and her entire office. It goes without saying, is like she was using this incident to raise money for her reelection to circuit attorney, district attorney, whatever you call it. And sorry, I forgot to mention that. Before indicting the McCloskeys, Mark at least, she was using the incident to raise money for her reelection. After using it to raise money for her reelection, she then indicts and then uses it again afterwards. She gets booted from the file for conflict of interest, appearance of impropriety, obviously. So two questions, because I think I understand why, but do you understand why she was only disqualified from Mark McCloskey's file and not Patricia McCloskey's?
Just because my understanding is that for some reason their files have been severed and have different judicial assignments.
Okay.
She still may be kicked off the other one. If she was doing the right thing, she would voluntarily withdraw from the other one, but we'll see.
All right. And now, you have to explain to us how this can happen, because it's not just an abuse of the law. It's not just an abuse. It's abuse of prosecutorial discretion. How does this happen? I mean, how does this happen in a civil law abiding, law and order society?
Well, you often have people who brandish a case for their political careers. But what's rare is to promise an indictment in exchange for a donation. So it's just Democrats taking things to their logical conclusion. This is another George Soros-funded prosecutor. Soros has been heavily involved in trying to reshape American prosecution. That's what we saw the controversy this week in L.A., where the new L.A. prosecutor was very dismissive of victims of a terrible crime while he was lowering the risk threshold for the defendants involved in the case. And so it's amazing. It's like the late 1960s, early 1970s all over again, because that's when we had a wave of, hey, let's be kind to defendants. Let's help criminals. They expanded the definition of certain kind of rights beyond what was politically palatable at the time. And it led to a massive law and order backlash. So I think that backlash is coming. The only question is when and where. But I think the judge was even – when a judge is so disturbed that the prosecutor has been so overtly political in a file that she's willing to disqualify them, which is unusual, highly unusual event to occur, it tells you how bad it's got. And in St. Louis, I have a case that's coming up in St. Louis that involves a major bank involved in politically manipulating loans to favor and disfavor their political adversaries or political allies, as the case may be. It's just really bad in St. Louis. Ferguson was the beginning of sort of the center of woke revolution in certain parts of the professional class world. And it just got overt and extreme there. But it's what's happening in many places. It's just it was just particularly bad in this case.
And now a civil servant asks, how does the ABA not disbar her? So I imagine she is a member of the American Bar Association.
Well, probably not. The American Bar Association is actually just a voluntary group. So your bar license in America. So in the United States, your bar licensures are controlled by your local Supreme Courts. So now sometimes that will have a bar association that has been delegated the task of enforcement. But ultimately, it's always the Supreme Court of the state that ultimately controls your bar licenses. Now, they will sometimes have, like in Wisconsin, the Office of Lawyer Regulation, and California, to some degree, the California State Bar implements aspects of what the California Supreme Court's rules are. But ultimately, it's up to the court. And they never touch prosecutors. I think, the Chicago Tribune did a study years ago, 2,000 cases where judges found serious misconduct by prosecutors. Only two ever faced any ethical ramifications. Our system is here to punish the outsiders, not the insiders.
And now people are going to start getting suspicious about Cleopatra. Cleopatra, thank you very much for the support. Aha, they let me send another one. Okay, thank you, David and Robert, for your time and for your time tonight and every Sunday. I hope to be available next week to see both of you again. God bless. Happy holidays to both of you.
Yeah, Merry Christmas. I mean, it might be a useful bridge into what crimes does Santa commit every Christmas Eve?
You know, the funny thing is I did a joke video about that, like back in the, you know, the early stages when I started doing law themed videos. Let's do that as the final wind up, because we're at an hour 46 anyhow. And well, it's a funny thing. Go for it. And I'm going to see if I'm going to go look for some comments and see if we should cover other stuff.
Well, I think you probably do have trespass. Though, even though you're doing the trespass for the purposes of to benefit, it's not like you want random people coming into your house to give you things. So it probably is trespass, but I don't think it could be called burglary because it's giving you something. It's not taking anything from you. So I think trespass is about it. You could argue public nuisance, depending on whether it's as loud as the National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation one, which is my favorite Christmas movie, bar none. But I think trespass is about it. Maybe speeding. Maybe some traffic rules and regulations, depending on, you know, one open question as we get into it is most of our traffic rules currently only apply to vehicles that are on the ground. Like, they don't apply to planes. Don't really. There's special rules that will apply to planes and helicopters in certain circumstances. But I don't know whether they would apply to the unidentified flying object of Santa and his reindeer. So I think trespass is about it. And maybe it's excusable trespass for the purposes of public there's certain kind of defenses out there you have available to you. Famous whistleblower case in the United Kingdom related to the Iraq war there, and issues related to the British, how the British were handling it, had a certain public defense. There's a range of public defenses people forget. A lot of the people who are trying to do trespass on nuclear power plants had these public defenses, that when something's in the ultimate public interest, there's various defenses that can potentially, they're hard to apply, but can potentially apply. They're also applied when people went in and burned draft cards. The argument was it was for the better public benefit. Some of the folks robbing banks in the 1930s believed that, because they would go in and they would burn the deeds the mortgages had, the banks had on mortgages on farmers, so there would be no proof that the banks could foreclose on those farmers' property. That's why a lot of bank robbers were popular in the West those days. And then you have Jesse James and the railroad. Is there really such a thing as robbing from the ultimate robbers? So the variations of a public justification defense that maybe Santa could have, depending on the circumstances.
So there's some funny responses in the chat. Incidentally, everybody, stick in some questions that we didn't get to. I think we covered basically everything that we want tonight.
I was just going to go through the locals ones.
Oh yeah, absolutely. What are we expecting next in the election? Like, what's coming up this week? What should we look forward to?
So I think Trump just wants to build. I mean, he'll do every judicial remedy he can get. In Georgia, the judge is never assigning the case. That was the best election contest filed. They're refusing to even hear it, which tells you what's really going. When they see how strong the case is, they run away from it. There is a Georgia signature audit that is beginning, but there's ongoing debate about whether he'll allow meaningful monitoring to happen. So we'll see some of those developments. Will any of the courts step in? Will any other judges step in? And so that will be one track. Another track is does Trump pardon Assange or Snowden? Does he commute Ross Ulbricht's sentence, the Silk Road guy from New York? An old friend of mine, Joshua Dreitel, was his great defense lawyer in New York. And there's serious reasons to doubt the sentence and the whole way that case came about. So we'll be watching that for Christmas Eve, Christmas Day. And then otherwise, Trump is building the argument for the House and the Senate taking a meaningful examination on an electoral contest in Congress starting January 6th, for which people can continue to send letters to their Congress members and senators. Some people were already responding and posting that on the locals board. My template is still there. You can cut and paste, you know, from it, copy from it, steal from it, use what you want, not want, as you see fit. But I think people will continue to do that, and I think that's a good thing. And then we'll see what happens on January 5th and 6th. So there's nothing like big near short term, other than the report that's supposed to come out about whether China interfered with the election, or do they try to blame Russia again, and do they try to blame this most recent hack on Russia, which appears to be the goal of the deep state apparatus. And apparently, some of the Biden people are already looking at other places to invade. Looking at Ethiopia, apparently. I mean, why we go there, Lord knows. But So that will be some of the things to watch over the next week or two.
All right. And I'll get one question from, or we'll get a bunch from locals, but one, and it's, people have been asking it here also, it goes to the HIPAA violations. If private enterprise starts requiring proof of vaccination, how is it not a HIPAA violation? And what's the objection? What's the recourse?
That's my view, is it is an objection. And so we're looking at drafting template letters for that people can use, looking at legal research, looking at potential legal remedies, legal suits. The risk is if somebody comes in and says it's an exception to HIPAA at the HHS or any of those other departments and agencies up in DC. So that will be the risk. But we are looking at that option. We are also looking at the option of whether it's a discriminatory violation based on your either mental health response or physical response to potential vaccine risk. And every other claim that we can bring challenging vaccines by their nature, whether religious exemptions exist, whether this emergency rush through licensure went through the proper way. There's a lot of, and continuing to document in detail everybody that has an adverse reaction. Because the swine flu, they kept pushing it, the vaccine, and kept pushing it in 1976. I encourage people to go, you know, YouTube, 60 minutes, swine flu, vaccine, 1976. You type in those terms, it should pop up with Mike Wallace and the rest. And I think you'll see some useful information. And I think you'll see Trump continue to plan for January 6th, may issue those pardons, but otherwise, and try to get some informational development. He's trying to step on the warmongering with Russia, trying to avoid that, but we'll see how much success he has. But ultimately, he'll decide his next step after whatever happens in Congress happens.
And now, someone had asked in locals, and I think someone had asked earlier here, why can't Trump unilaterally seize the voting machines and conduct whatever audit he wants on his own authority?
He can't because that would be a just you. The feds could go in and seize that material based on a Justice Department. That's who could do it. There are theories out there that the cyber warfare unit could do it. Other people could do it. Not really. The military, again, folks, for people who don't know, after 1876, part of the deal was to never allow the military to ever be involved in U.S. elections again. So it is a federal felony, 5-year federal felony, to be involved at all in elections if you're a member of the armed forces, of any part of the armed forces. So he cannot use that power. So the Justice Department could open an investigation and they could seize whatever they want, subpoena whatever they want, but there's no reason to believe, frankly, that they will. Maybe they should, but you know that's late. And from the evidence I've seen, the machines were not the key source of the issue in this election. The issue in this election was whether people that were, was it a constitutional election because constitutionally unqualified people voted, the vote was cast in an unconstitutional manner, or the vote was counted in an unconstitutional manner, or in some cases, all three. It's not an issue with machines. I saw someone put out a report that said, oh, look, if you look at where the machines were, it's 5% more for Biden than would otherwise be the case. The problem was the premise. The person came up with a premise about what he thought the vote should be in all the counties across the country. And that premise does not have evidentiary substantiation when I looked at it. Richard Barris has had similar conclusions. He said the machines are not machines are a red herring mostly. I'm not, again, not a fan of machines, but they're not the key source of the problem. The key source of the problem was whether constitutionally qualified people voted, whether they cast their ballots in a constitutional manner, such as signature matching and ballot harvesting issues, which were illegal in most states, and whether or not the vote was counted in a constitutional manner, particularly with knowledge that for a presidential election, constitutional manner and method and means must be by the laws passed by the state legislature, not edicts issued by state judges, or state executive branch people.
All right, Mark, let's see. This is another question we can get to. How do I pronounce that? Mark, EDHK. Did you get my super chat question asking about ejecting states that won't?
I did see that. There's no for both of those issues. So secession, that issue kind of got resolved in the thing we call the Civil War. So the John Calhoun had many arguments for secession. If you want to go back and read those and why he felt states could secede, you can look at those. But as a practice, now there was always an open debate because they didn't just secede; they seceded and then they attacked a U.S. military base. And so that opened the door to argue that the North was defending itself against a Southern invasion or Southern attack. So never raised, you know, the legality of that was never clearly adjudicated, you could say. But practically speaking, the assumption now is that no court or federal government will allow any state to secede of its own accord. And in the same method that there's no means to kick a state out. Now, this does relate to another question that was on the locals board. What about adding a state? So Congress has broad authority, plenary authority to add. Now, here's what they can't do. They can't add a state from within another state. So now their procedure has been, so if the House and the Senate say Puerto Rico is now a state, say D.C. is now a state, say Guam is now a state, Mariana Islands now a state, then they're states. And constitutionally, they're put on equal footing. So, I mean, that's a concern that some conservatives have because they believe D.C. and Puerto Rico and some of these other territories would be Democratic states that would change the balance of power in the Senate and potentially also impact, in the case of Puerto Rico and other places, the Electoral College. Now, Puerto Ricans have gone back and forth on whether they want to even be part of a state. So, like, I mean, I knew people that were from Puerto Rico, went to Florida, and they're like, what is all this tax nonsense? Because they didn't have to pay certain taxes in Puerto Rico. So they're like, whoa, this U.S. citizenship is overrated. For their experience. So that's not a, you know, an obvious thing. I do not think it will pass. Most political analysts do not believe it will get through the House and the Senate unless Democrats have super majorities, which they do not have currently. But constitutionally, there's nothing to stop them from doing it.
All right. And now I'm going to bring this one up. But my last question for you, Robert, and a clarification for everybody. I brought up the comment that Sidney Powell, you know, did very good work in Michael Flynn's case.
Absolutely. And I recommended her for that. So I'm not an anti-Powell person. I just think she got caught in a disinformation campaign that no matter what anyone tells her, she doesn't listen and she's getting herself in bigger and bigger trouble. And the point is, I mean, Lynn Wood has been insane for a year. Lynn's sanity is a problem. But the just ask any of his partners that worked for him for years. But yep. But Sidney, I think, just got caught in a disinformation campaign. I think to some degree the general has. Flynn.
I was just going to ask you this because Flynn is, you know, openly tweeting support and, you know,
he's torching his career. This is what people who wanted him to never get near a position of power. He's helping them by what he's doing right now. So, I mean, that's why people like me are being more public about, hey, stay away from this because this is bad. But unfortunately, they're just not listening. And I don't think this will end well for her in particular. But for Lynn Wood as well. And it will hurt the reputational interest of General Flynn, unfortunately.
All right. And that is a perfect time to end it so I can keep it under 2 hours so that Eric Hunley, check out his channel as well, but he rips this so I can put it to Rumble afterwards and make sure it's safeguarded. Everybody, thank you very much for tuning in. It was another great one. I would say no midweek stream, no chance of it. So don't get the
hope. Christmas.
It's Christmas. Sorry, that's right. So next Sunday, but in the meantime, everybody, thank you all for tuning in. Thanks for the support. Robert, thank you for the insights and the discussion. We'll do it again next week. Everybody, yes. happy week. Oh. And Robert, you know what? We got 30 seconds. Leave us with an optimistic word.
Sure. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Kwanzaa. And whatever other holidays out there. Happy holidays. Whatever those holidays may be, anywhere and everywhere you may be. So it was my father's favorite time of year. And I don't think you can be depressed at Christmas time because it's Christmas time. So be happy and be of good cheer.